You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. In the last show, we were looking at the section on conscious parenting. The next section is Nature's Head Start Program. You may be wondering why evolution would provide such a system for fetal development that seems so fraught with peril and so dependent on the environment of the parents. Actually, it's an ingenious system that helps ensure the survival of your offspring. Eventually, the child is going to find itself in the same environment as its parents. Information acquired from the parent's perception of the environment transmits to the placenta and primes the prenate's physiology, preparing it to more effectively deal with future crises that will be encountered after birth. Nature is simply preparing the child to best survive in that particular environment. However, armed with the latest science, parents now have a choice. They can carefully reprogram their limiting beliefs about life before they bring a child into the world. The importance of prenatal programming undermines the notion that our traits, both positive and negative, are fully determined by our genes. As we have seen, genes are shaped, guided, and tailored by the environmental learning experiences. We've all been led to believe that artistic, athletic, and intellectual prowess are traits simply passed on by our genes. But no matter how good one's genes may be, if an individual's nurture experiences are fraught with abuse, neglect, or misperceptions, the realization of the gene's potentials will be sabotaged. Lisa Minnelli acquired her genes from her superstar mother, Judy Garland, and her father, filmmaker Vincent Minnelli. Lisa's career, the heights of her stardom, and the lows of her personal life are scripts that were played out by her parents and downloaded into her subconscious mind. If Lisa had the same genes but was raised by a nurturing Pennsylvania Dutch farming family, that environment would have epigenetically triggered a different selection of genes. The genes that enabled her to pursue a successful entertainment career would have likely been masked or inhibited by the cultural demands of her agrarian community. A wonderful example of the effectiveness of conscious parenting programming is superstar golfer Tiger Woods. Although his father was not an accomplished golfer, he did make every effort to immerse Tiger in an environment that was rich with opportunities to develop and enhance the mindset, skills, attributes, and focus of a master golfer. No doubt, Tiger's success is also intimately connected with the Buddhist philosophy that his mother contributed. Indeed, genes are important. But their importance is only realized through the influence of conscious parenting and the richness of opportunities provided by the environment. Conscious mothering and fathering. I used to close my public lectures with the admonition that we are personally responsible for everything in our lives. Such a closure did not make me popular with the audience. That responsibility was too much for many people to accept. After one lecture, an older woman in the audience was so distressed by my conclusion that she brought her husband backstage. And with tears contested my conclusion. She did not want any part of some of the tragedies she'd experienced. The woman convinced me that my summary conclusion had to be modified. I realized that I didn't want to contribute to fostering blame and guilt on any individual. As a society, we're too apt to wallow in guilt or scapegoat others for our problems. As we gain insights over a lifetime, we become better equipped to take charge of our lives. After some deliberation, this woman from the audience happily accepted the following resolution. You are personally responsible for everything in your life. Once you become aware that you are personally responsible for everything in your life, one cannot be guilty of being a poor parent unless one is already aware of the above-described information and disregards it. Once you become aware of this information, you can begin to apply it to reprogram your behavior. And while you're on the subject of myths about parenting, it is absolutely not true that you are the same parent for all your children. Your second child is certainly not a clone of the first child. The same things are not happening in your world that happened when the first child was born. As was said above, I once thought that I was the same parent for my first child as I was for the very different second child. But on second thoughts, when analyzing my parenting, I found that was not true. When my first child was born, I was at the beginning of my graduate school training, which for me was a difficult transition fraught with a high workload accompanied with a high insecurity. By the time my second daughter was born, I was more confident, more accomplished research scientist, ready to start my academic career. I had more time and more psychic energy to parent my second child, to better parent my first daughter, who was now a toddler. Another myth I'd like to address is that infants need lots of stimulation in the form of black and white flashcards or other learning tools marketed to parents to increase intelligence of their children. Michael Mendiza and Joseph Clinton Pierce's inspiring book, Magical Parent, Magical Child, makes it clear that play, not programming, is the key to optimizing learning and performance in infants and children. Children need parents who can playfully foster the curiosity, creativity, and wonder that accompanies their children into the world. Obviously, what humans need is nurture in the form of love and the ability to observe older humans going about their everyday lives. When babies in orphanages, for example, are kept in cribs and only provided with food, but not one-on-one smiles and hugs, they develop long-lasting developmental problems. One study of Romanian orphans by Mary Carlson, a neurobiologist at Harvard Medical School, concluded that the lack of touching and attention in Romanian orphanages and poor quality daycare centers stunted the child's growth and adversely affected their behavior. Carlson, who studied 60 Romanian children from a few months to 3 years of age, measured their cortisol levels by analyzing samples of saliva. The more stressed the child was, as determined by higher than normal levels of cortisol in the blood, the poorer the outcome for the child. Carlson and others have also done research on monkeys and rats demonstrating crucial links among touch and secretion of the stress hormone cortisol and social development. Studies by James W. Prescott, former director of the National Institutes of Health section on human health and child development, revealed that newborn monkeys deprived of physical contact with their mothers or social contact with others develop abnormal stress profiles and become violent sociopaths. He followed up these studies with an assessment of human cultures based on how they raise their children. He found that if a society physically held and loved its children and did not repress sexually, that culture was peaceful. Peaceful cultures feature parents who maintain extensive physical contact with their children, such as carrying their babies on their chests and backs throughout the day. In contrast, societies that deprive their infants, children, and adolescents of extensive touch are invariably violent in nature. One of the differences between populations is that many of the children not receiving touch suffer from somatosensory affective disorder. This disorder is characterized by the inability to physically suppress surging levels of stress hormones, a precursor to violent episodes. These findings provide insight into the violence that pervades the United States. Rather than endorsing physical closeness, our current medical and psychological practices often discourage it. From the unnatural intervention of medical doctors in the natural process of birthing, for example, separation of the neonated for extensive periods from the parents into distant nurseries, and the advising of parents not to respond to their babies' cries of fear for spoiling them. Such practices, presumably based upon quote-unquote science, undoubtedly contribute to the violence in our civilization. The research regarding touch and its relationship to violence is described in full on various online websites, for example, www.violence.de. What about the Romanian children who came out of deprived backgrounds and became what one researcher called the resilient wonders? Why do some children thrive despite their backgrounds? Is it because they have better genes? But now you know that I don't believe that. More likely, the birth parents of these resilient wonders provided a more nurturing pre- and perinatal environment, as well as good nutrition at crucial points in the child's development. The lesson for adoptive parents is that they should not pretend their child's lives began when they came into new surroundings. Their children may already have been programmed by their birth parents with a belief that they are unwanted or unloved. If more fortunate, they may have at some crucial stage in their development received positive, life-affirming messages from their caretakers. If adoptive parents are not aware of pre- and perinatal programming, they may not deal realistically with post-adoption issues. They may not realize that the children did not come into the world as a blank slate any more than newborns come into the world as blank slates, unaffected by their 9 months in their mother's womb. Better to recognize that pre-programming to work, if necessary, to change it. For adoptive and non-adoptive parents alike, the message is clear. Your children's genes reflect only their potential, not their destiny. It is up to you to provide the environment that allows them to develop to their highest potential. Notice I did not say that it was up to parents to read lots of parenting books. I met lots of people who are intellectually attracted to the ideas I present in this book, but intellectual interest is not enough. I tried that myself. I was intellectually aware of everything in this book, but before I made the effort to change, it made no impact on my life. if you simply read this book and think about your life and your children's lives, that they will change, you're doing the equivalent of accepting the latest pharmaceutical pill thinking in that it will fix everything. No one is fixed until they make the effort to change. Here's my challenge to you. Let go of unfounded fears and take care not to implant unnecessary fears and limiting beliefs in your children's subconscious minds. Most of all, do not accept the fatalistic message of genetic determinism. You can help your children reach their potential and you can change your personal life. You are not stuck with your genes. Take heed of the growth and protection lessons from cells and shift your lives into growth whenever possible. And remember that for human beings, the most potent growth promoter is not the fanciest school, the biggest toy, or the highest paying job. Long before cell biology and studies of children in orphanages, conscious parents and seers like Rumney knew that for human babies and adults, the best growth promoter is love. A lifetime without love is of no account. Love is the water of life. Drink it down with heart and soul. Epilogue. Spirit of science. The most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the power of all true science. Albert Einstein.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, Ph.D. Before the break, we were starting the epilogue, Spirit and Science. We've come a long way since beginning this journey, when I faced my panicked medical students and started my journey to the new biology. But throughout the book, I have not strayed far from the theme I introduced at the beginning, that smart cells can teach us how to live. Now that we're at the end of this journey, I'd like to explain how my study of cells turned me into a spiritual person. I also want to explain why I'm optimistic about the fate of our planet, though I concede that optimism is sometimes hard to maintain if you read the daily newspaper. I specifically separated my discussion of spirit and science from the preceding chapters of the book by entitling this section the epilogue. An epilogue is generally a short section at the end of the work that details the fate of its character, in this case, moi. When the awareness that prompted this book first came into my head 20 years ago, I saw something in it that was so profound and immediately transformed my life. In the first instant of my big aha, my brain was reveling in the beauty of the newly envisioned mechanics of the cell membrane. A few heartbeats later, I was overtaken by the joy that was so deep and wide My heart ached and tears flowed from my eyes. The mechanics of the new science revealed the existence of our spiritual essence and our immortality. For me, the conclusions were so unambiguous that I instantly went from non-believer to believer. I know that for some of you, the conclusions I'm going to present in this section are too speculative. Conclusions drawn in the previous chapters of the book are based upon a quarter of a century of studying cloned cells and are grounded in the astonishing new discoveries that are rewriting our understanding of the mysteries of life. The conclusions that I offer in this epilogue are based upon my scientific training. They do not spring from a leap of religious faith. I know conventional scientists may shy away from them because they involve spirit, but I am confident in presenting them for two reasons. One reason is a philosophical and scientific rule called Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor holds that when several hypotheses are offered to explain a phenomena, the simplest hypothesis that accounts for most of the observation is most likely the hypothesis that is true and should be considered first. The new science of the magical membrane in conjunction with the principles of quantum physics offer the simplest explanation that accounts for the science of not only allopathic medicine, but also for the philosophy and practice of complementary medicine and spiritual healing as well. Also, after so many years of personally applying the science I've outlined in this book, I can attest to its power to change lives. However, I concede that while science led me to my euphoric moment of insight, the experience resembled instantaneous conversations described by mystics. Remember the biblical story of Saul, who was knocked off his horse with a lightning bolt. For me, there was no lightning bolt that came forth from the Caribbean skies. But I ran wild-eyed into the medical library because the nature of the cell's membrane that was downloaded into my awareness in the wee hours of the morning convinced me that we are immortal spiritual beings who exist separately from our bodies. I had heard an undeniable inner voice informing me that I was leading a life based not only on the false premise that genes control biology, but also that the false premise that we end when our physical bodies die. I had spent many years studying molecular control mechanisms within the physical body, and that astonishing moment came to realize that the protein switches that control life are primarily turned on and off by signals from the environment, in other words, the universe. You may be surprised that it was science that led me to that moment of spiritual insight. In scientific circles, the word spirit is warmly embraced as the word evolution is in fundamentalist circles. As you know, spiritualists and scientists approach life in vastly different ways. When life is out of whack for spiritualists, they beseech God or some other invisible force for relief. When life is out of whack for scientists, they run to the medicine cabinet for a chemical, and it's only with a drug like Rolaids that they're able to spell relief. In fact, that science led me to spiritual insight, and this is appropriate because the latest discoveries in physics and cell research are forging new links between the worlds of science and the world of the spirit. These realms were split apart in the days of Descartes centuries ago. However, I truly believe that only when spirit and science are reunited will we be afforded the means to create a better world. A time of choice. The latest science leads us to a worldview not unlike that held by the earliest civilizations, in which every material object in nature was thought to possess a spirit. The universe is still thought of as one by the small number of aborigines who survive. Aboriginal cultures do not make the usual distinctions among rocks, air, and humans. We are all imbued with spirit and invisible energy. Doesn't that sound familiar? This is the world of quantum physics, in which matter and energy are completely entangled, and is the world of Gaia, that we discussed earlier, a world in which the whole planet is considered one living being, a breathing organism, which needs to be protected from human greed, ignorance, and poor planning. Never before have we needed the insights of such a worldview more. When science turned away from spirit, its mission dramatically changed. Instead of trying to understand the natural order, so that human beings can live in harmony with that order, modern science embarked on the goal of control and domination of nature. The technology that has resulted from pursuing this philosophy has brought human civilization to the brink of spontaneous combustion by disrupting the delicate web of nature. The evolution of our biosphere has been punctuated by five mass extinctions, including the one that killed the dinosaurs. Each wave of extinction nearly wiped out all life on the planet. Some researchers believe, as I mentioned earlier, that we are deep into the sixth mass extinction. Unlike the others caused by galactic forces such as comets, the current extinction is being caused by a force much closer to home, humans. As you sit on your porch and watch the sunset, note the spectacular color. The beauty in the sky reflects the pollution in the air. As the world we know decays, the earth promises an even greater light show. Meanwhile, we're leading lives without moral context. The modern world has shifted from spiritual aspirations to a war for material accumulation. The one with the most toys wins. My favorite image for the scientists and technologists who have led us to this spiritless world comes from the Disney movie Fantasia. Remember Mickey Mouse as the hapless apprentice to a powerful sorcerer. The sorcerer instructs Mickey to do the chores in the lab while he's away. One of the chores is to fill a giant cistern with water from a nearby well. Mickey, who has been observing the sorcerer's magic, tries to bypass the chore by applying a spell to a broom, which turns it into a water bucket-carrying lackey. When Mickey falls asleep, the robotic broom fills and then overfills the cistern, flooding the lab. Upon awakening, Mickey tries to stop the broom, but his knowledge is so limited he fails, and the situation gets even worse. When water takes over, until the sorcerer, who does not have the knowledge to quiet the broom, returns and restores the balance. Here's how Mickey's predicament is described in the movie. This piece is a legend about the sorcerer who had an apprentice. He was a bright young lad, very anxious to learn the business. As a matter of fact, he was a little too bright because he started practicing some of the boss's magic tricks before learning how to control them. Today's very bright scientists are Mickey Mousing around with our genes and our environment without understanding how interconnected everything on this planet is. A course of action bound to have tragic results. We're going to be reading the conclusion to this book in the epilogue in the next show. So please stay tuned, and I wish you a good week.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we wish you the best for the new year.